This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. Hello.
Gigi, do you ever get the feeling that economics should be easier to understand than it is?
Well, I try to make it easy to understand for my students, Peter, you know, and actually I was
That's
lucky.
That's your job, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I was lucky enough to have my first exposure to economics be in a classroom when I was an undergraduate. And I was only shopping this class because a friend had said maybe I would enjoy it.
This was just you're going to almost audit the course.
Exactly. I was doing a liberal arts degree, so you had to take a little bit of stuff outside your major anyway. So I went in and sat in this lecture, and it was given by John Giannakopoulos. And he was young, dynamic. He just had a son, and he was bringing his, you know, stories, personal anecdotes about his family life into his discussion. And he made us all in the classroom do an active trading market game there on the floor of the lecture theater, where he said, okay, you guys are going to pretend to be consumers, and you other half of the class are going to pretend to be suppliers. Some of you guys are going to really have a high value for the good being traded. Others are not going to want it at all. The suppliers, some are going to have a low cost of production, some are going to have a high cost, and you guys just go and trade. And yeah, I found myself wrapped with his lectures. And this particular experience, this first lecture, it was like an alcoholic having his first drink. I remember thinking, oh, this is a discipline that has codified the way I already think about the world. How great. And so it just naturally sucked me in. I found it very intuitive because I had that great teacher.
But he did it by games or by simulations rather than a list of principles. I had to learn cross-country skiing with my dad. And our instructor, instead of teaching us what to do, he said, we're playing a game of soccer, right? Taking away your socks, you've just got your skis, you're one team, the people with socks, particular colour socks, you're the other, play. And by the end of it, we'd forgotten that we were skiing.
Yeah.
So the other way, the awful way, my daughter, year 11, she studied economics. I counselled her not to, but she did. And at the beginning of the course, her teacher, day one, said, there are these 10 principles you need to know. He went through the lot. Right. And these are things that sort of emerge. And what are they called? The Mankiw.
Greg Mankiw. He is the top-selling economics textbook author, I think, for the last maybe 20 years. And indeed, there are 10 principles, I hate to say 10 commandments, of economics
like that
are introduced very early in the book. And I agree with you, Peter. I think that that type of presentation tends to make the student think that the discipline is somewhere out there that they can't quite touch. It's distant from them. It's not something they can feel. It's not something that is in them already. It's this externalized list of rules. It's very disheartening. It's non-emotive. It doesn't make people feel good, right? Right, which is a big principle of education for me,
oh,
anyway.
No.
Right,
you completely need to turned her off.
Yeah, of course, that's the opposite of what you want as an outcome from a good educational process. You want to associate the discipline with positive feelings in order to engage students and make them want to study it more.
These views about the Ten Commandments or the 10 principles have fed through into popular culture. Do you know about the stand-up economist?
Oh, I love him. He's awesome.
Yoram Barum.
Yoram Barum. He's PhD educated. Now he's a stand-up comedian.
Here's what he says about them.
Great. So the best-selling textbook, economics textbook in the country is by N. Gregory Mankiw, based on these 10 principles of economics. Great, let's simplify this. So choices are bad, really bad. If you don't understand why choices are bad, you're probably stupid. Next principle, rational people think at the margin. Translation, people are stupid. Now, it is immediately obvious to the most casual observer with the meanest intelligence that people do not think at the margin. Nobody goes to a grocery store and says, I'm going to buy an orange. I'm going to buy another orange. I'm going to buy another orange. But if people don't think at the margin, and if, as Mankiw says, rational people do think at the margin, we are led to a most unhappy conclusion.
Like the Ten Commandments, there's a lot of redundancy built in.
Very much so.
With the Ten Commandments, you can basically simplify them to four. And funnily enough, that's what the guest that we will hear from shortly has done. Justin Wolfers has reduced the 10 principles to four. Only four. But let's get back to games.
So there are several different games that one can play with economics. I play games with my children every day around the dinner table about economics. There was the game that John Janakopoulos played with me. But there's a new generation of games in the classroom.
The first game is very old, a hydromechanical description of economics. You put water in, some of it goes to income, some of it goes to tax, some of it is diverted, some of it shoots up again like a pinball machine, and they've actually got one of these at Melbourne University. Do you want to know where it is now?
I would love to, because it's so hands-on. I think that's an incredibly powerful way to demonstrate to a child.
It's broken.
Oh, no!
So it sprung a leak.
too much trickling down.
A beautiful thing. Basically, that model of the economy wouldn't work anymore, apart from the fact that it's broken, because it is, and this is what I like about it, it's something where things are changing, where knowledge actually improves. Now, knowledge improves in other fields too. It improves in physics, obviously, right at the moment. Pharmacology, people are trying to get a cure for vaccine. But in economics, it improves because people's behaviour changes and people can look into themselves. So it sort of changes more quickly.
Oh, but I think that the basic principles of economics are essentially the same as they were back in the 1950s. I think it's just a question of figuring out better ways to communicate them. That technology has changed. The technology of communication definitely has changed. I still like that model. Kids can come and touch the water, touch the tax flowing out. I think it's a brilliant way. But
what's the modern version?
Well, there's a version that's at my department, actually, that was co-invented by two of my colleagues, Alberto Motta and Isabella Dobrescu.
It's at the University of New South Wales.
Yep, in the School of Economics, Playconomics.
Playconomics.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So it's essentially a video game that is set up to teach economics from a very hands-on experiential standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So each student in the class every term is an avatar in this game. And as that avatar, they can choose what they want to maximize, what their objective function is. People want to maximize profits or happiness if they're a consumer. So students can choose one of those, or they can choose something else like world peace or dominating other countries or starting a war or anything else. And they make decisions in the game about how to allocate their resources. They can then trade with each other in this game environment, and that trade generates a positive effect for everyone. So the same principles are in that game that were being taught back in the 1950s, but it's being taught in a very experiential way, in an interactive way, but it's just a really fun way to learn. So as you know, Peter, we've experienced changes in the way education is delivered recently, and one of the big resources that's been developed is something called Core Economics. It's free to download. It's an initiative generated from the London School of Economics, and it essentially tries to meet people who don't want to enroll in an economics degree. They don't want to spend a lot of money to learn economics, but they really do want education in what the discipline has to offer, and it starts with policy-relevant questions.
Starts with real problems as opposed to principles.
Exactly. So, for example, are you concerned about inequality? If so, okay, let's look at inequality. Let's look at how it arises in our societies.
And it plugs in real-world data in real time, right? So if I look at it next year, it'll show me updated facts to this year.
Yes, it's all based on what's actually happening in the world today, and it allows students to understand how economics can illuminate those problems. Some other examples of policy-relevant questions are things like the economics of innovation and environmental sustainability. These are topics that a lot of people listening to our show probably are interested in, and yet they don't really want to have to go get an economics degree. And they don't want to have to buy a textbook or a license for Playconomics, so the CORE initiative is a really good resource for them. We'll put a link to all of the different resources we're mentioning on our website so you can explore them at your own time.
And CORE is free. So when this program finishes, when our series finishes, you can, if you like, continue the journey in an accessible way. Coming up on The Economist with me, Peter Martin, and Gigi Foster, those four key principles narrowed down.
A Australian Justin Wolfers is the co-author of The Newest Big Thing in the Teaching of Economics. It's an entirely new book, also called Principles of Economics, like Mankiw's book that we spoke about earlier, written with American economist Betsy Stevenson, who featured in an earlier episode, actually, of our program, The Economists. And this new book essentially rebuilds knowledge in light of new knowledge from the ground up. It's being trialed in the American market this difficult semester. Justin is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Hi, Justin. Thanks for being on our program.
It's a pleasure, JJ.
So first of all, tell us, what motivated you and Betsy to embark on this Herculean effort of writing a new economic principles textbook?
It is Herculean. Some number of us care deeply about the nature and fundamentals of capitalism. And if I had all night to drink port and wear leather elbow patches and smoke a pipe, I would love to talk about that. But to me, economics is more immediate, more everyday, more a part of all of our lives. So I want to equip my students. The term I use is I want to teach them useful economics. As an economist, I know that every day I make decisions informed by an intellectual framework called economics. I've used that framework to decide everything from whether or not to come on your radio show today to whether I should take the bus versus taking an Uber to deciding how many children I have. I believe I've made better decisions because I've used the economic framework. And so I want to give that gift to the next generation of students.
Well, how do you begin? Where does economics for you begin? Now, for me, a long time ago, it began with supply and demand curves. Where does it begin for you?
So I begin the first day of my first lecture, I say economics is not just about money. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just important because so many students come in thinking that what they're going to take is a bad business course. And then what I do is we tried to boil all of economics down to what we call core principles, but they're the building blocks. It means that when you approach a problem, you ultimately use four basic tools. And the first is the cost-benefit principle. Which is the view that you should take account of the full set of benefits and the full set of costs.
You would have done that deciding how to come here today, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Some economists call this idea the idea that the incentives matter. So how do I think about costs and benefits? Well, that's where I get to the second principle, which is called the opportunity cost principle, which is you always say, or what, right? So I could have walked here. So you might think, therefore, the price of walking here is $0. That's not right, because there's an or what. I could have walked here or caught the bus, in which case I would have been able to read along the way. So the fact that I couldn't read an article on my way here was a cost, would have been a cost of walking. And so opportunity cost principle helps us discover some of the costs that an accountant wouldn't find, but are really important to making good decisions.
So this is something, this is a concept that I hit so heavily in my first year course too. And I mean, it's a difficult term really, because when we think about opportunity cost, it's really a value of a benefit. It's a foregone benefit that you never see. It's not in any spreadsheet, right? It's in the mind of the person who foregoes. And it is the value of the benefit foregone when you've chosen the thing you've decided to do, right? And it's a bit of a thought experiment to get students to understand that. And what, you know, sometimes people call it a threshold concept. Once you cross the threshold of really understanding what opportunity cost is, then you start to be able to think like an economist and realize all the things you're foregoing all the time. It makes you ruthless with your time allocation, I found anyway, right?
It certainly made you ruthless, Gigi. here's how I do it. I just teach my students, anytime you ask a question, should I catch the bus? That's not a reasonable question. It's not a well-posed question. It's always, should I catch the bus or what? Any sensible question ends in or what. And as soon as you say, or what, or take an Uber, or walk, that's the opportunity cost. So those two words identify what's hidden.
You said there are other principles. One of them is opportunity cost.
Yes. So the first was the cost-benefit principle. The second is the opportunity cost principle. The third is what we call the marginal principle. This is a brilliant innovation that's over 100 years old. And this is basically the idea that anytime you face a question, it's how many. How many hours should I work? How many people should I employ? How many children should I have? It's always going to be simpler to say, should I do one more? We call that thinking at the margin. So if the answer is yes, you should have one more child, go ahead, we'll have one more child. And after that, say, oh, I've got two now. Should I have one more? And you should keep doing things as long as the answer to that question is yes, which is to say you should keep doing things as long as the benefit of doing one more exceeds the cost of doing one more. Translating that English sentence back into economics, we'd say you should keep doing things until the marginal benefit is no longer larger than the marginal cost.
Why is that not obvious?
Well, it is. Economics can be both obvious and correct, but the art of this The great joy is that you just said it's obvious. Now, there's a way I could have taught you that that would have made it not obvious. I would have said, how many hours should I work? And I would have said, well, my utility is a function of the number of hours that I work. How do I maximize my utility? And I would say, I take the first order condition, which means I take the first derivative and I set the derivative to zero. That's how I was taught.
Me too.
I just, yeah, that's not a joke.
No, and on graphs, where you can match the slope of the two lines to each other, the two curves.
On our end, this is The Economists with Peter Martin and me, Gigi Foster. Joining us in the studio is Justin Wolfer, speaking about his new book, Principles of Economics, co-written with fellow economist Betsy Stevenson.
So what's the next principle? You said that I think there are four.
Yeah, so they're the first three. And the last one is, it's a little harder. It's called the interdependence principle. And the view is, maybe the superpower of economists is that we can see linkages between things that other people can't. So money that I spend buying a new couch is money I can't spend buying a TV. That's interdependence of my own decisions. There's interdependence between your decisions and mine. If you line up at the shop and buy the last donut, there's no more donut for me. There's interdependence between markets. As women's wages rose over the last 30 years, so did the demand for childcare. So the labor market is affecting the childcare market. And there's interdependence over time. Inflation reflects a lot what people think inflation will be in the future. So today's decisions depend a lot on what will happen in the future. And what you can do in the future depends a lot on the decisions you made in the past. This is how economists think. This is the way GG thinks about everything. The difficulty here is, how do we teach an 18-year-old who doesn't understand why it's important how far-reaching it is? And that's what we're trying to do.
So it sounds to me like you're motivated, but what I like to think of as the almost purest motive that an economist can have, which is, I want to make the world somehow better. And in your case, you want to communicate more effectively to young people. That sounds all very altruistic. I mean, Justin, there's got to be something else. I mean, don't we teach as economists that people are greedy?
No. First of all, I don't teach that. I don't.
Right.
Some people are greedy. Some people aren't. I teach my students that when you want to think about the costs and benefits of doing something, you should think about the full set. Of course, this book comes with a price tag and there's a financial side of it. But I will tell you, when it's 2 a.m. and I've been hammering away at one paragraph and I'm thinking to myself, how can I make this clearer? It's because I can think about the student I once was. And if the author had only done that little bit of extra effort, I would have understood economics a little bit more clearly. And I hope there's a million students like that who read my book. And I hope they go on and live. Yeah, no, you don't have to be greedy.
All right. Well, can I ask it another way? It concerns me, I must say, as someone who sees the world in the way that Gigi does, in the way that you do, as trade-offs that need to be made, it sort of concerns me a bit that if we have economics taught, and it would be easier to teach in the way you are, in a widespread way in year 11 and 12, that we'll get a whole lot of people who go around doing conscious calculations. And I don't know why that worries me. Perhaps it's not the way we should be doing things. It's one way of doing things.
They're already making those calculations. Which idiot decided to have another child without thinking, you know, if I have unprotected sex now, there will be precisely no consequences? I get it. Poets and philosophers don't really like economists. They piss on us because, like, we are just sort of a low-level social science and they have fancier dinner parties than we do. But the reality is, all I'm trying to describe is the decisions that people make already. I honestly think every decision people make comes from thinking hard about costs and benefits.
So, Justin, this book has been trialed in America just this term. What are the initial reports? What's the reception like?
The thing that I've been most heartened by is instructors who sometimes didn't want to use our book, they reporting the students are doing the reading and then coming to class more engaged. And it's a funny thing, a textbook, because I'm writing for the student, but the person who assigns the book is the instructor. And, you know, what we want is as many students as possible to try it out, and then they'll put pressure on their instructors to, you know, hopefully modernize the way they teach economics.
Is it going to come to Australia?
We hope so.
It's an American textbook.
Yes. So, no, I should be clear. It's an international textbook, and there is an international edition, which you could currently buy. And there are some Australian universities who are going to use it straight away. But in the longer run, there are some unique characteristics of the Australian economy. and we should make sure Australian classes reflect those. And so we are talking to some of the leading Australian economics communicators to see the book hit Australia. I was an Australian economics student once. I care a lot about that.
Thanks very much, Justin. Lovely to speak with you. Thank you again for being on the program today.
Thanks.
You're listening to The Economists on Radio National with me, Peter Martin, Gigi Foster. It's not just the two of us who've been scratching our heads trying to come to terms with economics in a time of coronavirus these past months. It's also you. And as they say, Gigi, we've got mail.
So exciting. I love it.
Our executive producer, Georgia Power, has kindly agreed to read out some of the biggest issues raised. And she joins us. Hello, Georgia.
Hello.
What do you have for us first?
Well, Barry has written in. There is no discussion about the American debt situation. I've been watching their debt clock. Recently, their liabilities were at $147 trillion and their total assets, $144 trillion. As far as I can tell, they're broke. Is this true or not? Can you explain what's going on? There's a similar one from Ray regarding the Australian government's borrowing of several billion dollars because of the COVID-19 crisis. He wants to know, who is this borrowed from? How is it actually facilitated, and who does that?
We can answer those questions, I think, but I love that who is this borrowed from question, because I don't know if you've seen this, Gigi, that the world is awash with debt, mm-hmm. and the world owes so many trillions.
Yep.
And you keep thinking, who to? Like another planet?
All the aliens from Mars.
You know, all these Martians must have been lending a lot of money. So it washes out. As it happens at the moment, we have huge number of people wanting to lend money to governments because governments are safe. We had a bond issue. The Australian government had its biggest ever sale of bonds. That's, if you like, sale of pieces of paper promising to repay. $19 billion a fortnight ago. It was oversubscribed twice. That's how eager people were for a safe place to put their money.
So in other words, Peter, the answer to Ray's question, who is this borrowed from, is all of us. People who buy bonds, government bonds.
Yeah, so Australians are lending to Australians, foreigners are lending to foreigners, and fortunately it comes when the government is desperate to borrow. The Reserve Bank has been promising that it will step in, but it's barely needed
to. It hasn't needed too much. And going back to this question of whether debt is always bad, right? Is the U.S. broke, right? Essentially, if the government is borrowing in order to spend on things that help the economy in the longer run, then that's a good thing.
The worst thing ever is a recession. And multiply that for a depression, right? That is what you want to avoid. And it is worth borrowing from willing lenders an awful lot of money to avoid that happening. The very best thing you can do is to avoid a recession. If you have to borrow big, it'll pay off.
Yep.
Do we have another letter, Georgia?
We do. And we love this email. Ajit has written in and he has said, I've been an active listener of The Economists since last year and I have learned a lot. So thank you for that. My question is, how does the value of the Australian dollar fluctuate alongside trade and the money produced by the Reserve Bank?
So this is a great question that goes to the fundamentals of economics, supply and demand. When there is more demand for something, the price of it goes up. When there is more supply of it, the price of it goes down. And that's essentially in the case of money, just as much as in the case of any other good. So when people demand more of a currency, that means that the price of that currency is going to go up, which is essentially the exchange rate.
Why might they be demanding more Australian dollars, which would push up the price?
They might want more Australian dollars in order to buy more of our stuff. When we have a strong export industry, that means people around the world want to buy Australian goods. To do that, they need Australian dollars. So that's the interaction between the capital account and the current account balances. The capital account is about your money going back and forth. The current account is the goods.
And you might wonder why the Aussie isn't sinking with all of this borrowing that the government's doing, because it needs to sink relative to something. And every other country needs to sink relative to the US dollar, and they're doing a bit of borrowing themselves.
Yep.
Do we have one more question, George?
Yes, we do. Finally, we've heard from Michael. Peter and Gigi, the political and economic mantra for a prosperous economy is economic growth. But it seems to me that economic growth is about infrastructural, urban and residential expansion, which will surely eat into what remains of our unique and precious natural domains. What is wrong with economic sustainability without actual physical expansion?
So this is a great question, and I get this question quite a lot from people on email and in the classroom. There's nothing wrong in principle with the idea that we want to caretake natural resources and have a sustainable economy. But, well, the principle thing comes into play because the reality of the situation is that people around the world, in every country, are going to continually innovate, they're going to continually create new ways of doing things differently, and they're going to want to accumulate more stuff, more status, more income, more whatever. We are a species that's very competitive and highly creative.
You're trying to say we can't stop growing, we can't stop getting more out of each unit of work because human beings continue to make things better. That's what we do.
We do.
Working groups. We make processes better.
Yep.
What we've got to bear in mind, though, economic growth, that is getting better at things, making more, does not mean using up more resources. The iPhone is a classic example. As far as I can tell, it's got hardly any metal in it, right? Cars use a lot less metal than they used to. Lots of the things that we're now growing in, that we're now doing better, are services. They're virtual services. They don't use the world's resources. So when people say, oh, we're going to run out of resources, we can't keep growing forever, yes, we can. Humans cannot stop growing, cannot stop, if you like, getting more out of each unit of labour, because that's what we do. And also, we like it. And we had Justin Wolfer's co-author, Betsy Stevenson, on our program talking about how happiness is very much related to how many more things we're getting, and they needn't be physical things. I don't think we should stop growth, but that's just me.
And that's The Economist for this week. We'll put links to Justin Wolfer's and Betsy Stevenson's new book and everything else we talked about today on our program page. That's The Economist at ABC Radio National. That's also where you can send us your feedback about anything we've covered this season. Just scroll to the bottom of the page and click on Contact Us.
And that's where you can listen to this program and all the others again, as well as via the ABC Listen app or where you get your podcasts. Next week, our final show for the season. It's been a privilege to broadcast to you, our listeners, during these extraordinary and unexpected times.
They truly have been, and it's been a pleasure to bring to bear the power of economics to try to understand how to make our world better.
So fittingly, next week, the truth about the economy up to a certain point. The March quarter national accounts will tell us how bad things were before they got really bad in April and the months that followed. The figures might turn out to be good because there was a run on toilet paper and flour and so on in March, but we will get two experts who can pull them apart and tell us everything we know. See you then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.